Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guests are Margaret, Irene, and Andrew Lee, the sibling co-owners of the May May Group, a Boston-based restaurant, food truck, and catering company with a focus on innovation, sustainability, and great service. Led by Chef Irene, May May's creative Chinese-American cuisine combines Chinese techniques and influences with local New England ingredients. Their food truck, May May Street Kitchen, is amazing and delicious, and it opened in 2012 and was soon awarded Boston's Best Meals on Wheels by Boston Magazine. Their brick-and-mortar restaurant opened in late 2013 and was named Eater Boston's Restaurant of the Year. I've been a big fan of the restaurant and this family because of their dedication to sustainable operations, employee education, and ethical sourcing. They are truly leaders in New England, and I would say the country's food scene.
Oh, thanks.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
This has been like a long time in the making, I feel like. And I don't know if you know this, but this past weekend was awesome, in part because of you guys. So you have this awesome cookbook that just came out called Double Awesome Chinese Food. And this past weekend, my husband and I, we made scallion pancakes, smacked cucumbers.
Nice.
And dumplings for the first time.
Awesome.
By hand.
That makes us so happy.
They were so ugly that I didn't post them, but it was just such a great experience, and so I just wanted to tell you guys thank you so much, and like I can't wait to cook more out of this book. It's great.
Yes, wrap it up. It's a success. We're done. Our work is done.
They were really bad looking though. Like I kept looking at the pictures in the book and being like, oh.
No, there's no such thing as an ugly dumpling.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
That's what's
on
the inside.
They're
that
all
counts.
Beautiful.
Exactly.
That should be on a t-shirt.
Good. It's actually on a pin. It's on the inside that counts, so, you know, trendy enamel pin. It's pretty sweet. We're going to give you one, actually. So,
oh, yeah. Yay. So let's back it up a little bit, and let's talk about how this all came to be.
Oh, you could go far back.
Let's go
that.
Way back.
Yeah. You know, we have grandparents who are in the food service business, Andy, who's been in hospitality for ages. The cookbook itself was just something we'd want to do for such a long time. We are, you know, the people who read cookbooks like novels and have a stack of them by the side of the bed, and you'd always got a cookbook going. And so it was a dream come true to get to work with Roost Books. They're wonderful. And put together this compilation of recipes that are, it's kind of a combination of food we grew up eating plus food we serve at May May, all kinds of Chinese American influences, and really just a mashup of the food we like to eat.
She said mashup.
It's mashup.
Do people still say mashup?
I don't know.
Cool. I think so.
I'll allow it.
But yeah, like it's truly a family business. And, you know, I mentioned it in the intro, like, you know, how you treat your employees. Like, I've never met someone who's worked for you guys that hasn't also been like glowing, like raving.
Oh my gosh.
Working for you. Yeah, which is very rare in our industry. So, you know, congrats on that.
Just recently, actually, Irene, the team that she's put together, they won a some recognition from Food and Wine as one of the best 20 restaurants to work at in the country, which was a really big deal for me, like seeing that coming from a corporate background where the employees were not necessarily always the biggest concern, you know. Really happy to see that, and just a testament to everything Irene's put together over there, mm-hmm. in particular. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even go through the accolades for you.
That's okay.
Chef
Irene. Let's make her feel awkward. Yeah. I love attention.
I mean, we have to do this. 4-time James Beard
Big Rising Sister Bragg
Star Chef semifinalist.
Sorry, it's 5 times now.
Five.
I have to say that as her big sister.
5. Excuse me. 5. Zagat and Forbes 30 Under 30. Eater Young Gun. You like hip hop dance videos. I mean, I could go on and on.
It's very bewildering.
So tell me, when people ask you about the food of Mei Mei, how do you describe it?
It's really hard to describe because in some ways it's such an organic product of who we are as people, where we grew up, the food we grew up eating. So we try to call it creative Chinese American food, modern multicultural Asian food. And then if all else fails, we just say it's Chinese food with cheese. since cheese is not typical to Chinese food, but it is typical to our dinner tables. Mm-hmm. So I think that definitely a lot of guests come into the restaurant and are looking for lo mein or sweet and sour pork, and we kind of have to bring them along with us and say, yeah, we have a bunch of stuff that we made up and you've never tried before, but we think you might really like it. And so, you know, that's sort of the work that we have to do to tell people about what the food is.
Yeah, just reading the book, there's so many like little great stories in here about like each recipe and each chapter, and so many great pictures of your daughter. I mean, adorable. I'm curious, do you have a favorite recipe that's in here?
That's a great question. There, it's like kind of like picking a child, but one of my favorites is actually it's underrated because there's no photo of it, but there's a cumin lamb shepherd's pie. So we had a babysitter from Minnesota who made shepherd's pie for us when we were kids, and we took that, combined it with the sort of cumin lamb that's popular in northwestern China, and made this kind of spicy, toasty version of a shepherd's pie that my Scottish Chinese husband is totally obsessed with. He's like, ooh, mashed potatoes and everything, plus cumin lamb. So that's a great one just for families and dinner parties and stuff.
I think my favorite is the spring green curry with halloumi cheese in it. Obviously, we all love Thai curry and have eaten that from our favorite Thai takeout places since we were kids. For me, actually figuring out how to make Thai curry, we mostly learned to cook watching YouTube videos and like binge watching different TV shows. So learning to make Thai curry was really cool. And as we were sort of trying to change the curry season to season, we made the spring green curry. And instead of putting tofu in it, we decided to put cubes of halloumi in it because cheese. And so when you bite into that piece, you're expecting tofu maybe, and then surprise, it's the best. So I love that recipe because I think it's a little bit unexpected, but the flavors you can totally get behind even if you've never had something like that before.
So for me, the recipe that brings back the most memories is actually the double awesome scallion pancake sandwich. It's arguably our signature dish, and we've sold many, many, many of them. And it, so it's 2 slow poached, then fried eggs. So the yolk is still runny. Some house-made pesto and cheddar cheese. And we fold it all into a grilled scallion pancake. It brings us back to the days when we were on the food truck, you know, before we had a restaurant. And we were all yelling at each other and going crazy and, you know, eggs were everywhere and pancakes were everywhere. Yeah. It was a really good time. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that actually, I have that part highlighted here in the book where you talk about the creation of like your signature dish from, you know, heating up scallion pancakes as kids and hot, like from the freezer in hot oil. Yeah. And then just like playing around with that until you found this combination of things that worked. And even the name of the book.
Double Awesome Chinese Food.
Yeah. Was there ever like a discussion of it being something else, or was it always like, this will be the name of our cookbook?
We had actually started with the name Family Style. So the idea was, you know, us as siblings, it's always been a family business. This is the three of us siblings, and our mom is, we call her like our number one publicist and our harshest critic. So, you know, if she's right sitting outside.
Oh, there she is.
And so she lets us know what she thinks all the time, which is wonderful. And so Family Style kind of represented that. But then we decided we wanted something that was even more fun and indicative of what was inside. And I think the Chinese food combined with the Double Awesome shows hopefully that it's a little more modern, that it's, you know, not just, it's not your mom's Chinese food, it's not your grandma's Chinese food, and, you know, makes it a fun title.
Mm. Yeah, it's the Double Awesome. I mean, if you tried to take that off your menu at some point, what would happen?
Riots in the streets.
We've created a monster.
Yes.
But we think we're putting at least one of the kids of our egg farmers through college.
Yeah.
So we're pretty happy about that.
Well, there you go. That's great.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
Exactly.
So speaking of farmers, you also have this like incredible commitment to working with local farms in New England. Can you tell me how that came about when you were, you know, starting your food truck?
Well, I'm definitely the farm zealot out of the three of us. I spent some time living on a farm in high school, and then I went to college at Cornell in upstate New York, and I just totally fell in love with the farmers market when I was there. And I also made some friends with folks who were doing, you know, real sort of farm-to-table cuisine. And seeing how much work they put into it, you know, they would drive to the slaughterhouse, they would pick their own tomatillos for salsa. It kind of occurred to me, you know, I don't think every farm-to-table restaurant back home in Boston is necessarily doing that. So when we started talking about opening a business, I thought, let's see how well we can do at sourcing locally. And it's been amazing to see local food infrastructure grow so much in Boston over the last 6 years. So we can now get things like fresh turmeric and baby ginger, you know, stuff that you would never expect to see growing in the Northeast. And I think that's one of the reasons why we attract the staff that we do, because it really means a lot to them to be able to support other small businesses. And I think so many of them actually come from farming backgrounds and have never cooked before. Mm-hmm. And we think that's just really awesome.
Mm-hmm. And some more big sister brag. Part of what Irene is not saying is that she's helped get these farmers into Boston, because she's said, you know, if we'll make it worth your while to distribute here, we'll find you other restaurants, we'll talk to chefs, we'll make sure that they know about your products, we'll make it so, you know, driving in from New York is worth your while. So it's been really cool to see how the local food infrastructure has grown, in part because of Irene's support.
Mm-hmm. And I think Maymay is such a great case study and example of a successful business growing out of you know, a food truck, because it's not just the brick and mortar. You also have sauces and a shipping container. Can you go through kind of all the different Maymay entities that exist, just for listeners to like really get a sense?
Well, I guess I can start by saying we expanded very organically in the first couple years of running the business, and then we have trimmed down very intentionally also. So right now we're actually just the restaurant, and we keep the food truck for catering. So this year we're probably going to cater 20 different weddings all around the Boston area. So we did have the food truck on the road 5 or 6 days a week when we first opened. We started a line of sauces, sort of pantry sauces that combined classic Chinese flavor profiles with really sort of wholesome, honest, local ingredients. And then we did also have a shipping container, sort of cafe kiosk in the Seaport neighborhood of Boston. And we don't have those things anymore because we've really been excited about focusing on the restaurant and trying to do, as you said before, as much as we can around employment before we actually expand again.
The good story about the shipping container is actually that one of our former employees who was helping us run it now runs it himself, and he runs his own business out of there. So we kind of, you know, acted as a like a case study or an incubator for him, mm-hmm. almost, and he's doing really well. We're really happy for him.
I'm curious if you could go back to starting. Your mom is looking in right now. She's like smiling. Hi, Mom. If you could go back to, you know, that first day on the food truck, what would you say to yourself?
You'll get through this. We started we started with the idea of being a mostly dumpling-focused truck, and we wanted to do it the way that we grew up doing it, which is making the dough from scratch, rolling it out by hand. It takes a very long time, and we basically stocked up on dumplings and then pretty much sold out of all of them the first day. And it was like, oh crap, we need to figure out how to make more food very, very quickly, which is kind of how the scallion pancake sandwich got invented. So it's one of those things where, you know, you get lucky with how things turn out. But we were overwhelmed by the support and the love at the beginning, and it was amazing. You know, Boston was ready for some more food trucks doing different things. And, you know, we loved it from the very beginning, but it was also a lot. A lot going on.
So you would, what advice would you give yourself to think about as you move through, you know, your business and your careers? Like, what would you say to your younger self on that food truck?
I think I would tell myself to go to the gym because I think that all of us have had, you know, foot or back or shoulder injuries. And, you know, I probably would have bought clogs earlier on. But I don't know. I think there's so much that we have learned through this process. It would be very difficult to catalog all of it. But that was part of the fun of working with each other mm-hmm. in this way for the first time, and also being in an industry that was very new in Boston. So as much as we had no idea what we were doing, I'm going to go ahead and say the city of Boston also was not super sure what they were doing. So I think we all kind of got to grow into that together, and that was really awesome.
If I could have given myself some advice back in the early days, I would have told myself to run fast.
Away from the truck?
Away from my sisters. No, but it was great. You know, we've working with your family is challenging. We've had ups and downs. And, you know, 8 years later or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seven, eight
years later. I wouldn't have done it any other way. You know, we've actually been able to step away and look at different projects ourselves. Margaret now lives in North Carolina with her two kids, and Irene has taken over daily operations, which is, I like to think that that's how I engineered it in my mind when we started. My dad actually, so our father used to say something that that resonates with his training at the Dana-Farber Hospital in Boston. He would say, find the best and the brightest in your field and get out of their way. Hmm. And that's what I did.
That's very sweet. We should add also that Mei Mei means little sister in Mandarin Chinese. So it was Andy's idea to open the food truck initially, and his two Mei Meis strong-armed him into naming the business after us. And that was just a preview of what was to come.
But he got out of the way. Yeah. Let it happen.
Yeah. There may have been some more strong-arming in the years to come. Just a bit.
But I should say also that, you know, my brother and sister trusted me, a 22-year-old with no formal training, in a way that no sane business owner ever would have or should have. And so, you know, when I reflect on the accolades and how weird it feels, I know it's because I had this incredible platform to work from. And so I think that is what has made all of this possible for me. So I am really grateful for that.
It was like flying in a plane, and Irene would just kind of like go to the cockpit and say, I'm going to fly
a plane.
I got
it. Now. You're like, oh,
like,
my God.
I've flown on planes before. I can do this. I get it. We're in the air.
And it worked out.
All worked out. Yes.
You're on the ground.
Yeah. Yes.
Safely.
Yes.
Safely.
Exactly.
So speaking of like working with, you know, the best and brightest, I think the way that you treat your staff is so... I want to say admirable, but it's basically how staff should be treated. Mm-hmm. You know, admirable makes it sound like it's like, you know, good job, when really everyone needs to be treating their staff well. I'm wondering, like, what is your philosophy with your employees, and how do you approach being like managers and chefs, and how do you approach that?
Well, I think that for me, what really got me started thinking about how we employ people, I think we were 3 or 4 years into the food truck and 2 years into the restaurant. And I was sort of looking around at the people who had been with us since the beginning, people who had seen me come through like this sort of formative phase of my life, who I felt like I had almost grown up with in some ways, like our sous chef, Emily, who dropped out of her neuroscience PhD at MIT to come work on a food truck for minimum wage. And, you know, looking at her, it was so clear that she could go anywhere else and make so much more money. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, one day Emily might want to own a car or buy a house, you know, do these things that are normal for people, but not necessarily normal if you make a cook's wage. And so it really felt to me like in order to justify all the incredible people who chose to work at Maymay actually making the money that they were making, we just had to be an employer who goes above and beyond. And as you say, of course, you know, the status quo in restaurants can be so low that baseline decency can mm-hmm. seem like a really big deal. But I think that for us, you know, we've always been a family business and we still take that same attitude towards our staff, which is, you know, it's not worth it to us to exploit you and to overwork you if in the end you're going to be really unhappy here.
Right.
I was in charge of bowling and pizza parties for the staff.
Wow, that was a great role.
That was my contribution, yeah. Maybe some alcohol was thrown in there.
Yeah. What kind of pizza would you get? Now I have to know.
Well, you know, bowling alley pizza.
Did you ever go to Lanes and Games in Arlington?
No.
Oh, so they had Candle Pin downstairs and 10 Pin upstairs and mac and cheese bites deep fried.
Okay. I don't know. Favorite. I've never been Candle Pin bowling. I know. I lived in Boston for 9 years, and candlepin bowling, for listeners who aren't familiar, is literally bowling pins that are super thin, and the bowling ball is way smaller.
It's so tiny. It's like it's almost a little larger than your fists put together, and that's how we grew up bowling, and so I remember seeing real bowling for the first time.
You were like, what is this? Why is this bowling ball so heavy?
Why is the ball so big?
Yeah, that's the only way I've done it, but I will get to candle pin. Now that I know that there's mac and cheese bites and pizza, I'll for sure do it.
Something else that Irene usually brings up, I'm surprised she hasn't already, you know, early, I guess, is the open book management program that she's instituted. Basically, long story short, is all the reports, all the sales, all the expenses are passed on to the employees so that they can get an understanding of the, you know, how the restaurant finances work and what their contribution is, how they can make a difference, you know, what the restaurant can afford to pay its employees and, you know, where the money is going. And I think that's been really successful. It gives everybody an extra investment. I don't know if you want to follow up on that at all.
No, I mean, I didn't say anything because I wanted to hear you explain it, but you did a great job. So, yeah, I mean, for us to try to teach some skills that are transferable, you know, to personal finance, or if one of our employees wants to open their own small business one day, that's been really exciting. Just how to read a profit and loss statement, how to understand what cost of goods is, what do you have to pay for in direct labor, all these sort of minutiae that I learned on the job, we can actually teach them and engage them in running the business. And I think that the best part of that for me has simply been feeling like I have so much more help. With May and Andy not part of everyday operations anymore, it's incredible to be able to talk to a line cook or a dishwasher about, you know, how high overheads look this period. So there's also a financial incentive for our staff, but I think the best part is just being able to, I don't know, talk to each other about things that seem like they really matter.
That would be a lot to carry for you as, you know, if you're thinking about all these things and everyone that's working for you has no idea what a P&L is.
Yep,
absolutely.
It's really great because my background in corporate restaurants is, you know, an hourly or a staffed employee even asking about the P&L would be unheard of and it would be considered proprietary, you know, for the company. Like they don't show that stuff to the employees on purpose. You know, it's almost hidden, it's secret. So Irene is you know, in particular, and the group Rethink Restaurants are turning that around and just changing the whole mentality.
I mean, if we were raking in corporate money, maybe we would have taken a different approach. But I mean, part of it, when a lot of companies go open book, is sort of saying, like, you know, I, as the owner of the company, am not buying yachts and top hats with the money that we bring in.
And monocles.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, that's, I think, a really important aspect of this for people who work in small businesses to understand that context.
Mm-hmm. And it really empowers employees in a way that, again, compared to Andy's corporate experiences, you know, they'd never take advice from, know, I was a waitress for a long time, and they've never listened to me on something, but it's the person who works with these products, you know, whatever, that you see how the paper towels are being wasted and can actually make a suggestion, and Irene will listen because you're the one who sees that every day. Dishwasher can make a suggestion on whatever, chemicals that are being used or anything. People are allowed to contribute in a way that is valuable and important, and Irene can learn something, and they can learn something too. Mm-hmm. Most places just don't let anyone have that kind of voice.
They don't, no. And again, it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
But it is. I'm, you know, this is kind of a big question, but what do you want people to take away from this book, from Maymay as a group? What do you hope diners take away?
One of the things that we kind of wrote the cookbook as is a starting point. And that is the way that I personally have always considered cookbooks. And is that, you know, we have provided a recipe and it's pretty detailed and exact, but you don't have to listen to it at all. We try to suggest ways to riff off of a recipe or substitute with what you have. And we want to provide some guidance and some ideas, but we don't expect you to follow it exactly. And part of that's about inspiring people to be more confident in the kitchen is that, you know, here's some tools and ideas we can give you, but we want you to have fun with it and take it into the kitchen and spill soy sauce on it and enjoy it. You know, if you have something that you want to put in your dumplings, like here's how you fold it and here's how you make the dough, but then you can make whatever kind of dumpling you want and it's going to be delicious and it's okay if it's ugly too. It's going to taste good no matter what.
I think also one of the things that May did a really incredible job with in the book is just infusing it with the energy of our family and of the sort of siblings and all the other folks who've been involved in our business since the very beginning. So both in the restaurant and when it comes to the book, I think we want people to sort of walk away with the sense that they have some sort of relationship with us. Even if, you know, we've never met or they've only read the book from afar, I think that there's so much personality in it, and it really tells a story about who we are and where our food came from. And we want the same thing in the restaurant. You know, hospitality is so important in Chinese culture, and a lot of what we do, we kind of model after when our parents would throw big dinner parties at our house. And so the restaurant, we try to make it feel as warm and welcoming as possible. And, you know, we want people to feel like they're coming into our house and just hanging out with our family.
Absolutely. And just to build on that, you know, even by the cover of the cookbook, you can tell like we're all kind of reaching for the same thing. Cooking is something that brings people together as well as the eating. And, you know, you can feel like you've done something tangible, you've created something and gotten to share that with other people and share that experience. So that's definitely part of what we're trying to portray here.
Yeah, it's really excellent. And we're going to get into those dinner parties and the dumplings from those dinner parties when we come back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. It's Todd Shulkin, the host of Inside Julia's Kitchen here on HRN. Inside Julia's Kitchen carries on Julia Child's legacy of introducing the brightest lights in the food world to a wider audience, just as Julia did from her home kitchen. Look for Inside Julia's Kitchen wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And fall asleep just to wake up.
All right, so we are back. And you know, we're having a little fun in the studio. What do you have there?
I picked a brown bottle off of the shelf here. I thought it was whiskey, and it's definitely gin.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen a brown gin before.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Surprise.
That's all right. This is something new for me, too.
All right. So we are back with Andrew, Margaret, and Irene Lee that own May May in Boston. And now I want to hear about these dinner parties that your parents would have. What was being served, and what was the atmosphere like?
Always pork dumplings, scallion pancakes. There would be someone standing at the stove just churning them out. And I always remember being ordered into the kitchen, handed a humongous tray of dumplings, and just being forced to walk around and give them to people. It's like, do you want a dumpling? Do you want a dumpling? Eat some dumplings. So that's pretty typical of all of us now, I think, is, the very Chinese auntie way of like, you haven't eaten enough. Do you need some more dumplings?
I also have all these memories of when our mom would make red-cooked pork shoulder, which is basically braised in soy sauce with black vinegar and brown sugar. And it smells so good. Mm. And you're smelling it cooking all day that by the time you get to dinner, you are just so ready to chow down on it.
You basically want to just drink the sauce.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there.
Just drank the sauce before.
And I think also our parents would throw a lot of parties and host dinners that were not typically Chinese. Like, we used to have lots of people over and do, like, a lobster boil. And, of course, we'd have white rice on the side because you can't have dinner in our house without white rice.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
That's a great accompaniment to lobster.
Yeah, so lots of fond memories of that.
Yeah, there's a recipe in the book about lobster, and our mom loves to do a classic New England style lobster boil. Even though she can't eat lobster, she's allergic to it.
Well, she's allergic?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
But she like owns the whole set of like lobster pots and lobster crackers and specific plates for eating lobster. And then our dad taught us how to break down the whole lobster from everything, like the tiny little piece of meat inside the fin and the legs. We would just like suck on the legs, and he really taught us how to, you know, take it apart and eat every single bit of it. And that's, you know, kind of the way he was, and I think our sensibilities about food have really developed from that.
He was a big fan of the tamale, mm-hmm. like the green tamale mm-hmm. in the lobster heads, and that's where we drew the line.
Like, nope, not following you there.
Yeah. No, we don't play like that.
My husband is a big fan of lobster legs too. He likes to get the meat out of them. I don't like the legs. I like the tail.
Yes.
And I grew up in Maryland, so like I'd rather have a crab.
Right.
But he's a big lobster little part.
Yes.
Get the meat out any way you can.
Yeah, exactly. Good amount of effort for not so much reward, but there's definitely a process to it that is important to us.
So one of the most amazing things about us cooking this past weekend, like from this book, was I had never made a hot water dough before. Mm. Can you explain to the listeners a hot water dough and what you can use it for?
So a hot water dough is what the Chinese use to create a lot of sort of pastry and bread type items. It's just three ingredients, hot water, flour, and a little bit of salt. And the goal, I think, of the hot water is to destroy some of the gluten in the flour, but not all of it. And the idea there is that you can then work the dough as much as you want, and you'll never build up more than a certain amount of gluten. We use it for dumplings and for scallion pancakes. There are variations that you can use for hand-pulled noodles. And it's just so easy to make. I think when people see us demo it, they're kind of amazed that it's just those three ingredients, and you can rest it in the fridge. You can make it in a mixer or in a food processor. And so that's a nice trick to have up your sleeve.
Yeah, it was... we didn't realize how easy it was either. Could you see the finished product? And it's so beautiful and like delicate and like looks intricate. And then you make the dough, and that's three ingredients, and you let it sit, and then you roll it out and put it together.
Simple.
And it's very simple.
Good for kids. It's,
yeah.
It's fun. I just, you know, like to poke at the dough. It's one of my daughter's favorite things to do. Poke at dough.
Has she helped out with the...
Yeah. She's obsessed with pizza making. And it's just, you know, dough and flour and making a mess are just classic kid activities. And parents get to clean it up. It's all sorts of fun.
And now it's your turn to host dumpling parties, exactly. And she can walk around with the tray.
Gotta put her to work.
She'd probably eat them all, but
probably.
Yeah, that could happen just too.
Find her in a corner hoarding all the dumplings.
Andrew, how is that brown gin treating you?
I'm gonna give it a minute.
You taste it and you're like, let me.
Well, gin's the one liquor that, you know, you may have had bad experience with. Everybody's got that one liquor. It's either tequila or
definitely
gin.
Tequila.
You know, I guess it's vodka for some people, but everybody's got one. It's all right, though. I'm not going to waste it. I promise.
So I always ask my guests about, you know, the role that dining has played in their lives. And I know you ate at home a lot, but did you ever go out to eat together? Were there any like dining out traditions that your family had?
Yeah, one of the big ones is of course Chinese restaurants, and every time we had a family reunion, which was usually a couple times a year, once with our mom's side, once with our dad's side, and we'd always sort of go take over part of a Chinese restaurant. So we have, each of our parents has four brothers and sisters, and then they all have kids, so you know, we'd take over three round tables of 10 and just pile it with food. So that's where we get these big trays of ginger scallion, lobster, and anything from, you know, kid-friendly scallion pancakes to, you know, pickled duck tongues or whatever, jellyfish, always starting a meal with cold jellyfish. So those are super important memories for us, is just like rubbing elbows with all of our cousins and, you know, getting to hang out with our aunts and uncles and just bond over food is solid family memories. Mm.
And what were the restaurants? Do you remember?
A lot in Southern California. There's a great sort of community of Chinese restaurants in the LA area, like Alhambra and San Gabriel. And we'd always just, you know, grandma and grandpa would pick a restaurant. And we'd all show up and just, you know, take over a whole corner.
There was one in Boston Chinatown called Golden Palace, which is unfortunately not there anymore. But it was like a standard back then. It's the one I remember.
Yeah.
I remember China Pearl. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we would intermittently do dim sum, which I think is one of the other really fun ways to eat that we love about Chinese cuisine. Because anyone can order. You can be like a kid hiding in the corner and like point at a cart, and all of a sudden you have like all these egg tarts in front of you.
Oh, yeah. Again, so, my daughter also loves dim sum.
Yep. So I think, you know, eating family style, like on the cover of the cookbook, playing with the Lazy Susan, eating the food that's about to go on someone else's plate, all of that I think is the fun of eating and cooking together that we really want to communicate in the book.
Yeah, it's very, the cover of the book, again, is kind of like that. It's just everyone's attacking the same plates and sharing, and that's, you know, what family style kind of means to us, is really appreciating and enjoying food together and picking off of each other's plates and trying everything. You know, there's no like my plate or your plate, or Andy's having a time with that gin over there.
Yeah, that gin's not going down well.
Don't mind me. I'm not doing anything. I didn't say anything.
So when you go out to eat now, if you do, because I'm sure you're all very busy, where do you tend to go? Do you have any favorite places that you like to eat at?
My favorite thing these days is Japanese hot pot. It's really, you know, it's light, it's clean. They bring you the food really fast because it's all raw. You get to cook it yourself. It's an activity, so I can, like, you know, you can do it with kids. That's one of the really cool things.
I eat a lot of Indian food takeout. That's sort of what we subsist on in our house when, you know, the week is really, really busy and we just want to eat a bunch of curry and then, you know, cook other things in it, like poach an egg and some chana masala or something like that. So, yeah, you know, I do surprisingly little cooking at home. I kind of don't really have the energy for it.
Yeah, situation. I feel like that's common for chefs.
Yeah, so, you know, we definitely eat some takeout, but incredibly, you know, my husband has started cooking and getting excited about, like, using our immersion circulator and all of that stuff. So it's nice to sort of sit back for once and let someone else run the show.
I'm really excited for summer to start so we can start grilling again.
Yes.
Yeah. Andy's a master griller. Our mom is a master griller. It's a strong family tradition also.
Thank you.
there's also sort of a new, I think, wave of restaurants in Boston that are opening that are run by young chefs of color who are, I think, similar to Mei Mei, putting sort of their own spin on a traditional cuisine and seeking to kind of elevate it and to bring it to a bigger audience. I've been lucky enough to travel to Hawaii a couple times in the last few years, and I just loved eating Filipino food in Hawaii because it was totally new to me. I had never experienced Filipino food before. And so when I got back to Boston, I was kind of like, there's one Filipino restaurant, and it's in Quincy, which is a little far away from where we live. So our friend Ellie, who just opened Tanam in Union Square in Somerville, is serving incredible Filipino food. So I don't know. It's exciting that there's kind of a next generation of immigrant and child of immigrant chefs who are expressing themselves in this really exciting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the food scene in Boston is really, there was always a food scene. It's really like blossoming. In the past, I don't know how many years, but it's been really cool to watch. And like being here for 2 years, like from afar, being like, oh, I want to go eat there and I want to go eat there, and I'm not there anymore, but you know, I can go visit.
Yeah. I think Boston still has a long way to go, which I could sense you saying that. And so I'll come out and say it. But you know, I think we really want to see more different kinds of food represented. Seeing more chefs of color would be incredible. The most recent Boston Magazine Top 50 restaurant list, we did a little analysis on it, and out of the 120 or so chefs and owners honored, there was literally one Black person. Shout out to Douglas Williams. And, you know, I think 15 or 20 of the restaurants were all serving Italian food. Mm. And, like, I love Italian food. Don't get me wrong at all. We just crushed some cacio e pepe out in the dining room, and I was really happy. But I think that, you know, there's just so much more out there, and there's so many more people living in Boston than our food scene really reveals. So hoping that that keeps changing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think people are always surprised when I tell them there's a large like Caribbean community in Boston. There's a large Puerto Rican and Haitian and, you know, Barbadian. I always mess that up. Bajan community. But yeah, Boston has these great, like, this great diverse population that should be reflected in the restaurant scene as well. And in the coverage.
Yes.
It's still, I used to write for Eater Boston quite a bit, and I don't know if they've had another Black writer since I moved, which makes me really upset. Because there are Black people there that would love to cover food in the city, so.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I know that Terrence Doyle at Eater is covering a lot more restaurants in the neighborhood, so I think there's progress there, but it's definitely true that most of the people in food criticism in Boston are still white, and primarily, I think, women. So watching you know, become so successful in your career, and seeing Solejo in San Francisco, and seeing that there's this new wave of voices in food has been super inspiring for me. And so hoping that that continues to grow in Boston as well.
Yes.
Okay. Andy's getting drunk on the gin over in the corner.
Please.
So, okay, from favorites to the worst, can you tell me about the worst dining experience you've ever had?
Oh, that's a good question.
And you can name the restaurant if you want to, but you don't have to. I know you have it.
Yeah. Porsche's like, I sent you this question, so this wouldn't happen.
I feel like I haven't had a bad dining experience in a while, which is a very lucky thing to be able to say, just because people are more aware of service nowadays and paying attention to, you know, there's also what online reviews and everything. There's just more focus on customer experience and everything. So I'm going to think about it a bit more.
I think the worst experience I've had recently was just being in a restaurant where I felt very unwelcome and I don't know, felt not significant to the people who were working there. And I'm definitely spoiled, you know, because I have a lot of friends in the industry, and so often if I go somewhere, you know, people might recognize me or I'll see my friends and then they know that I'm there. But it definitely, I think, was a reminder that For people who don't have friends who work in the restaurant industry, it's really easy to just be invisible when you walk in the door, if nobody greets you, when you're, you know, trying to get someone's attention and they just don't seem to see you. And I think that that's probably an experience that, many more people have than I myself am aware of. And so I think that, yeah, that was definitely a moment for me where I thought a lot more about what hospitality means and how we make sure people feel seen in our restaurants.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about you, Andrew?
I can't think of anything right now, but I'll get the 10-page list to you guys later.
It's a long list. Yeah.
I blocked those out from my memory.
But yeah, I think the feeling seen thing is so important. Mm-hmm. I think we forget about that in restaurants sometimes. Like, everyone doesn't feel seen when they go in to eat at places. And I think that experience must be, for you as a business owner, like, so, like, illuminating to, like, take back to your team and, like, talk to them about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, on our team, we talk a lot about use of pronouns and what it might feel like to be misgendered by somebody who greets you in a restaurant. We talk about how to work with guests who might have different disabilities or other needs. We are actually on a website called Purple Table, which is a list of restaurants that have expressed, you know, willingness and enthusiasm about hosting guests with different needs. So whether it's, you know, they need a table in a corner, or they need to be in a quieter room, or they just want to make sure that the place is even wheelchair accessible, which places are supposed to be, and a lot of them aren't. So I think for us, you know, making sure that we're incorporating that into what we do at Maymay is really important. Our dad had a stroke when we were younger, and so he was in a wheelchair for many of the years when we were teens and young adults and going out to eat and trying to find places that we knew would be comfortable for him.
Mm-hmm. And our mom was amazing about just sort of, you know, making sure he went out and was included in everything that we did. And she was really amazing about that, and a lot of people don't have those resources or don't feel supported, or again, you know what you were saying, don't feel seen, and so it's just everything from making sure that the wheelchair can actually fit into the restaurant is such a simple thing, and you know, something that people take for granted.
It actually, for me, it stemmed from my experience doing security at nightclubs, which was something that I did during school. Which was convenient. You know, I could work at night and go to school during the day. And it occurred to me at a certain point that there's no such thing as hospitality in nightclubs. You know, people, they want you to come in. They want you to spend money. They're going to tell you whatever they want to tell you. If they throw you out in the street, you know, they'll do that. And they don't care. You know, they'll tell you to never come back. So for me, just I always felt like if I ever owned a nightclub, you know, I would go the extra mile and try to stand out and say, hey, you know, thank you for waiting in line to get in this club for so long. You know, we appreciate your patience. We try to get you in as soon as possible. And, you know, that was something that eventually translated over into restaurants for me. It's, you know, it's still unheard of.
Yeah.
People expect to get treated poorly at a nightclub a lot of the time. And, you know, that it extends to certain industries. And, you know, when people feel like they're too busy to treat people the right way, we can always do better in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as proud little sister, I definitely want to say that I think Andy set the standard for hospitality on our food truck. And I think that is a huge part of why we were successful initially and why people from year one still come into the restaurant and they remember so clearly their experiences at the food truck. Because Andy, you know, he'd be in the window and he would actually say, thank you so much for waiting. And sort of, when was the last time you heard that from somebody on a food truck or even in, you know, a fancy restaurant? So I think that I just want to make sure that we say that, you know, that's been a really important part of our story, is trying to make people feel like, oh, you're a human and I'm a human and we actually care about you and want you to have a good time.
The organic byproduct of that is maybe they will come back, you know, and maybe they'll tell somebody about that. It's something that we try to spread, you know, spread the love. Mm-hmm. Good food always, you know, and good people.
Andy, I know you don't have a horror story from dining, but do you want to tell a story from Bugaboo Creek when you worked there?
Oh, God. I haven't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah.
Bugaboo Creek.
Well, they're defunct at this time, so I suppose
you,
I can tell
you can name them. You can. No one will sue you.
No, you know, nothing. Nothing too crazy.
Didn't a little girl puke on your shoes?
Oh no.
Okay. What are we talking about? What are we talking about? Are we talking about bad things that happened to me in my management career? Because I can get down with that.
You didn't have a story about, you know, a negative experience as a diner.
As a manager, though, it sounds like.
The Bugaboo Creek that I worked at, Bugaboo Creek was, you know, they were a good company. They were part of Rare Hospitality, which owns Longhorn Steakhouse.
Okay.
So there was like 350 Longhorns and like 15 Bugaboos. They had Timber, the talking tree, and they had the talking moose. I forget his name. But there was one Mother's Day, which, as we all know, is the busiest restaurant day of the year. Mm-hmm. And it was the center largest table. There was probably 12 people at it, and a mouse happened to run out in the dining room.
Oh, no.
And this thing will happen from time to time. In old buildings, you know, if they're doing construction nearby, nobody wants to hear about this stuff, but it happens from time to time. Mm-hmm. The mother saw it. She screamed and jumped up on the table.
Oh, gosh.
And, like, kicking dishes
in the dining room on Mother's Day
in the middle
Day.
Of the in dining the room. Of the yes, room. Oh, and goodness. she was just like, she wanted it out of there. So, you know, we were horrified. It's very embarrassing, but we did everything we could to recover that guest and make their, you know, turn that experience around and kind of like turn it into something they could laugh about. You know, we bought their meal, but it's not just about paying for stuff. You know, we just wanted to make sure that they were comfortable. We kept checking on them. You know, we made the little kids magic wands so that they could like, like wave away the mouse or something like that, you know. So yeah, it's just one funny story.
Yeah.
No,
wow,
you know, no
great.
Harm, no foul. And yeah, again, yeah, they're no longer in business.
They're no longer in business.
RIP talking
loose. Oh, yeah, RIP Timber.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad. Okay, so my last question is, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be, and who is invited?
Mine would definitely be a big Chinese restaurant, the whole family, everybody around the table. You know, you kind of get to have all the people that you love and all the foods that you want in one place, and there would be just unlimited ginger scallion lobster. Everybody gets all the pieces that they want.
For me, it would be at one of my favorite restaurants, Cafe Sushi, in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
We're both big fans of Cafe Sushi.
Yeah, yes. Seiji and his family are just amazing, and they always have these incredible specials that are species of fish that I've never heard of. And you know, I might pick one to try, but if it were my last meal, I would totally go all out. I'll have one of everything or two of everything. And you know, I think I would love to be with our team from Maymay. I think that would be incredible to have our family there, of course. And you know, for other big voices from food to be able to join us. I did get to meet Jonathan Gold once, as well as Anthony Bourdain, and as long as we're, you know, fantasizing about eating all
this
sushi.
Oh, yeah, anybody who has ever lived can be at your dinner. It's your last meal.
Yeah, so there are just so many people who I respect and admire who work in food, who have written about food, who have paved the way for other people, so I think to party with them would be pretty sweet.
That'd
be a
good
party. I think they'd really like Cafe Sushi,
yeah.
So maybe I'd impress them a little.
The best party, in my opinion, that we ever threw was actually, it was 150th birthday party my mom, dad, and Irene, 60, 70, and 20, respectively.
Wow.
And we roasted a pig. We had like a 20-pound fish
enormous.
As well.
Yep.
That it didn't even fit on the grill. The tail was like sticking out. it'd be a backyard barbecue like that. You know, all the friends coming by, the kids running around, you know, cold beer, very low key, but just, you know, people there, and you know, the pig is like entertaining to watch, and everyone's like focused on the food and getting excited, and just being with your people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you mentioned what you were drinking, but I didn't hear what you two were drinking.
Yeah, well, at the Chinese restaurant, it's going to be Qingdao beer. So our grandmother is from Qingdao, so shout outs to grandma.
Yeah. I think we'd probably be drinking sparkling sake. Poochie Poochie is what it's called. That's why it's my favorite. So, yeah.
Put in like a Poochie Poochie.
Irene served Qingdao beer at the James Beard House.
That's amazing. That's great.
And I was like,
oh. Yeah, like, oh, my God.
For the beverage pairing.
Make sure it's fresh. a lot of Qingdao beer is not freshest.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's a power move, though. I love it.
Some fancy people
were
there.
And they invited me back. So I guess, you know.
So it worked. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
This is so fun.
It was such a pleasure to have you. And the book is seriously amazing. Double Awesome Chinese Food is it available now?
It is. At all your local bookstores, all the online ones, too.
Amazon. You
know, yep, go check it out. Go find someone who's selling books, and they've probably got it.
We're also doing a signing at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn tonight, 7:30. Come through. We'll get drinks afterwards.
We'll go for Qingdao's.
Yes.
We'll get some Qingdao beer afterwards.
And where can listeners find out more about the restaurant as well?
Oh, yeah. Our website is Meimei Boston, MEIMEIBoston.com, and then /cookbook if you also want to find out more about the cookbook there.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.